You're listening to Start Writing, where we explore the great minds behind the greatest stories. Hosted by Joseph Bendosky, author of the Skyfall series, and Jay Washburn, author of the Star Child space opera. This episode is dedicated to my daughter. It's an interview with Gail Carson Levine. I'm sure you're familiar with her book Ella Enchanted, which was her debut novel, and it was awarded a Newbery Honor. In our interview, she is very vulnerable, and she speaks candidly about first getting published and how close she was to giving up. She also tells a touching story of how one of her books literally changed the life of one of her readers. I know many of you are listening to learn about the writing craft. Well, Gail teaches us about what it's like to be a writer, and she shocked me when she said how many pages she usually cuts from a manuscript. She tells a funny story about why historical research has become a passion of hers. And we also discuss two topics of personal interest to me, Greek mythology and Peter Pan. This was such a fun interview for many reasons, not the least of which is that Gail has a fun personality. I think I've never heard a greater hipster brag, and I usually don't like to spoil things in the intro, but she saw Bob Dylan in concert before he was cool. We talk about her background growing up in New York and about how her parents empowered her as a woman and how that then became thematic throughout her writing. It was a blast to talk with her, and I hope you enjoy the interview with Gail Carson Levine. Tell me what your day has been like so far.
Oh, it's been lovely. I went with a long walk with a friend, earlier I did a little writing. Just now I did a very little writing. It's very hot here. I don't know where you are.
I'm in Utah near Salt Lake.
So it's not raining today.
No. Yeah. And where are you in New York?
I'm about 60 miles north in a town called Brewster.
Cool.
Yeah.
Dang, that's great.
It's very hot today. Is it very hot there?
No, actually, it's a very nice day, very mild, finally starting to cool down.
Great.
Hey, well, let's just jump right into it. I have a lot of fun questions for you.
Okay, cool.
The first one is, tell me a story about your name. And this could be your given name, this could be a nickname, or it could be about your surnames.
Well, Levine, is often pronounced wrong as Levine, and because that's phonetic, but it's Levine.
Uh-huh. I was actually wondering about that myself, and then I listened to one of your audiobooks, and they said Levine, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, good. Which book?
The first of the Neverland trilogy.
Oh, okay. It's such a plain name, and it doesn't... that friend, my boss, actually, many years ago, used to call me Gailey when she wanted to tease me. I don't have a lot of stories about my name, because there's not too much to it.
Oh, okay. Well, honestly, that's just fine. So this is maybe the toughest question of the whole interview, but if you were a character in a novel, what is an interesting quirk that you have or something memorable that would make you kind of stand out as a character?
It may take the whole hour for me to come up with an answer for you.
Well, guess what? You can think on that one. I found something that you wrote about. You said you weigh 87 pounds and can bench press 90. And I would love to hear about your fitness habits and history.
And I got better after that. My top, it wasn't bench pressing. It was chest pressing on a stability ball. Okay. And at that point, when I was at my strongest, I bench pressed 135. Yeah. And I held 140, but I couldn't do anything with it.
Wow.
But I didn't drop it on my neck. And I injured two rotator cuffs, and I've just finished rehab. So because of that, and I did not have an operation, so they weren't repaired. They're still there. And because of that, and I work out with a trainer, he says I can't do bar chest presses anymore. So it's going to just be dumbbells, and now I won't ever achieve that again. Yeah. But, and we haven't gone that heavy because of that. And before that, I injured a hamstring. But I think we'll go heavy again on deadlifts. So I should be deadlifting more than my weight pretty soon. I very much like to be strong.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
How did you first get into fitness and lifting?
Into lifting because I was concerned about bone density. And then I went to a gym and I asked if I could try a personal trainer. And I met this guy, Tony, who was amazing and fun. And that's how I got into it because it was just so much fun to do. And he likes to say that I could lift 1 pound when he met me. It wasn't quite that bad, but it wasn't far from it. But I'm in anything I do, I'm very consistent. So I stuck with it, and I'm also very competitive. So I want to add a pound, add a pound, add a pound. So,
how old were you when you started?
Well, I was probably 52, maybe. So I've been working out with Tony for 25 years, not 23 years. Yeah.
What was it that got you onto the bone density question? Like, how did you know that was a concern?
I'm conscious. And also, if you look at me, you think my bones are going to be brittle. I am a poster child, and they're not that brittle, but I'm a poster child for I should have very brittle bones.
Do you happen to have a favorite book on health?
Oh, no. No. I mean, I look at the fitness columns in the Times, but I don't really read it. I just stay aware of what's going on.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite?
Well, I don't know if you've seen Outlive. It's on the New York Times bestseller list, and I got to recently interview one of the authors, and I just think it's a phenomenal book. It's really good.
So it's outliving.
Yeah, I mean, the point is to increase longevity, and he talks about increasing health span rather than lifespan.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, it's a really good book, really thorough, but also a fun read.
Yeah, Outlive. Okay, good to know. Yeah, I mean, there was an article in the Times just a couple of days ago about Elaine LaLanne, who was Jack LaLanne's wife. You know who Jack LaLanne was, right?
I actually don't.
He was a very early bodybuilder. And I think he was the first person to wear the kind of tight but wicking exercise clothing. I think he probably invented it. And he died in 2011. I don't know how old he was. But she's 97, and she's still walking on a treadmill, she hangs, she's, it was kind of cool to read the article then.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. And you mentioned that you went on a walk this morning.
Yeah.
Does that mean walking is a big part of your routine as well?
Yeah, cardio. I love to walk. But this was with a friend, so we were walking and talking, which was probably not as fast. But, you know, we kept up a decent pace.
Yeah,
we walked for over an hour, and it's this Utah is gorgeous. This is also a beautiful area. So we walked along a reservoir and on a trail that's got a lot of tree roots, and you have to look at what you're doing, and but it's also beautiful.
Yeah. Dang, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
It's such a cool habit or routine.
Yeah.
Okay, so I understand that you grew up in Washington Heights.
I did, yeah.
And so are you familiar with the musical In the Heights?
I know that it exists, but it was quite a bit after I lived there as a child. And I think the population became more, I think, Dominican, may have been Dominican or Colombian. And I think that's what the musical focuses on. Do you know it?
Yeah. In fact, I love it. And yeah, I would definitely recommend it. So they made a movie of it.
Ah.
And that's a really easy way to access it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me how growing up in Washington Heights, like, shaped who you are and who you became in your career.
Well, it probably had an effect on my walking. Seriously, because we live near the George Washington Bridge. We used to walk over the bridge a lot. And when the Macy's fireworks were on a barge in the Hudson, we had the greatest place to look at it from the middle of the GW Bridge.
Mm.
And then there was, a mile away was the Indian Museum, which now is in Lower Manhattan, and the Hispanic Museum. And we used to walk there. That was a mile south. And then a mile or more north was Fort Tryon Park and the cloisters. And we used to walk up there. And I remember being with a bunch of kids one day. I was probably in high school, and we decided to walk to Staten Island, you know, to the Staten Island Ferry. So walking was just an important part of my childhood, and a very good part of it. And also, you know, when we walked up down or up to those museums, we'd go in them and we'd walk around and look at this, at the art. And I that influenced me a great deal. You know, like in Ella Enchanted, the cloisters has topiary. And I always felt that they were torturing those plants. And that's in Ella. Yeah.
Tell me more. What do you mean? You felt like they were torturing the plants.
Well, do you know what topiary is?
No.
Oh, okay. Topiary is plants are pruned to take certain shapes. And I always felt that the plants might not have liked that. As a kid, I used to think that, and I put it in Ella. That was, and also, and I can't remember where I put this, but in the cloisters, there's a rosary bead, and it's about the size of a walnut, and it's open, and there's a town inside, and it's just astonishing. And I used to go and just stare at it. And so, you know, I don't know. I did use it quite directly, I think, in my novel, The Wish. But also, I just used to stare at it, at how tiny it was and how perfect. It was an astonishing thing. And then I'd look at the unicorn tapestries and the story of them. And then my mother would take me to museums, and she loved art, and she loved to go to museums. So that was important to me. And I used to walk to the local library, which wasn't far. And I used to borrow books by the barrel. So I just read. It was a great place to grow up. New York, because when I was 10, I was allowed to take the bus by myself. And when I was 11, I was allowed to take the subway. So I used to go ice skating with a friend. When we were 10, we would take the bus, which was slow. And when we were 11, we used to take the subway. And I could go to the beach. I didn't need parents to take me. There was a two-hour train ride that you could do to get to the beach. And it was a childhood that with a lot of exploration and culture, we would go to. I was in a kind of artsy crowd, and we would go and see Shakespeare in the Park for free in a big group of us. And when I was a little older, we would go to concerts, and we would usher. So we got to see the performances for free. I saw Bob Dylan before anybody knew him. Yeah. Yeah. So it was really a really rich place to grow up.
Yeah.
And, you know, that can't help but feed one's later artistic work.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like your imagination was just running wild even as a child.
I don't know. I didn't know that.
So I understand that there is a disparity between your parents' education levels.
Okay.
And I was wondering if you'd talk about that and kind of how your home life also helped grow you into the person that you became in your career.
Yeah. Well, my father had a tragic childhood, which is that his mother died in childbirth having him. And his father died when he was about five of gangrene. My father was born in 1912. And when I was a kid, antibiotics were new. It was when the life expectancy just soared. But when my parents were born, they were born into the world of tuberculosis, being incurable, and gangrene, you know, getting a cut could kill you. Which is what I imagined happened to my grandfather because he was a carpenter. So my father grew up in an orphanage, which he would not talk about. And, he was very smart, and they sent him to a high school off the campus of the orphanage. And it was his first taste of freedom, and he played hooky, and he didn't finish high school. My mother, on the other hand, whose mother recognized how important education was, even through the Depression, managed to make sure that her three daughters, and her son was born a little bit later, got through college. And they skipped kids a lot. And I don't think her sisters did, but my mother graduated from college at 16. And I don't think that was great for her because the children who were her classmates were so much older. And I think that's one reason why she was very shy. But my father loved having such an educated wife and such a brilliant one. And he was very smart too, but I think he didn't say this, but I think his lifelong regret was that he didn't get more education. But, you know, he read the Times from cover to cover. They were both math whizzes. They could add up columns of figures in their head. Both of them were great card players. They would teach, you know, they could hold all the cards in their head.
That's odd.
So, yeah, and I never had a feeling that being a girl was limiting. I mean, I must have, but I had it much less than a lot of other girls.
Yeah. Dang, that is so cool. So how old were you when you wrote your first novel?
I started writing for kids when I was 39. And I kept writing picture books, and I was afraid to tackle a novel. And I wrote a picture book about a kid who's an orphan. And an editor, Harold Underdown, who's still an editor, liked it and asked me if I could flesh it out into a short chapter book. And I was thrilled. So I did, and then he rejected it. But I kept working on it. It kept getting longer and longer. So that was the first novel I wrote. And I hesitated to say what year it was because, or how old I was, because I don't know. I was 39 when I started writing. Let's say that was 5 years later. I was 44, but I'm guessing. Okay. And it took me 9 years to get published, which I'm sure you know.
What were you doing before that, and what made you decide to give writing your best shot?
Well, I worked for New York State government, mostly having to do with able-bodied welfare recipients and finding jobs for them and finding ways for them to find employment. But I because there were layoffs, I took a hiatus and worked for the New York State Commerce Department. And I did some of their PR writing. And they loved my writing. And I was, you know, a huge reader. And so I happened to be meditating, but I was not really a dedicated meditator. And I asked why I never told myself a story. And that launched me. So I started to tell myself a story. And at that time, I was painting and drawing. So it was an art appreciation book for kids that I did some pencil illustrations for. And I did... I used famous reproductions of famous artwork in the story, and it was about an eagle who wants to. An eagle is very sick. He's the king of the birds, and his physicians tell him he'll get well only if he sees something beautiful. But he doesn't recognize the beauty in anything he sees until he has an epiphany. But no one would publish it, and it wasn't like kids' book then. But I just got interested, and my most important reading experience was as a kid, so that's where I went. And then I just became fascinated, and I started taking classes and joining critique groups and reading books about writing kids' books, and, you know, that. And I withstood all that rejection because I had friends who were being rejected too, and we kind of were all in the same boat. So I stayed with it. You know, if it hadn't happened when it happened, I may have given up because I was getting near, I was starting to feel that it never was going to, but it did just in the nick of time.
And that's crazy. And
yeah.
Such a close call. It's just interesting that a career can hinge on a small moment like that or a small amount of time. And
yeah,
I'm so glad that it's gone how it has.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so I would love to dive into your most recent book, Sparrows in the Wind.
Uh-huh.
And just for our listeners, like I know what it's about and I'll ask you some questions, but just give a pitch to our listeners and help them get excited. I think this is an awesome book, but tell us what's it about and why it makes you excited.
Growing up, I loved mythology. You know, it's over a year and I don't have an elevator pitch anymore, if I ever had one. But it's a retelling of the Iliad, which is a thrilling story from start to finish. Because there's never a dull moment in it. And the figure of Cassandra, who doesn't, if you read the Iliad, she's in it, I think, twice. She's not important. But she's a tragic figure because she sees every terrible thing that's going to happen. And no one will believe her when she says. And in my thinking about it, she's the heroine. She can't just wring her hands. So, and if you think about everything that happens that leads up to Troy burning, it's totally improbable. Too much has to happen. First of all, Paris, who instigates the whole thing, has to survive when his parents try to have him killed. So he has to survive, and he does survive. And then the gods have a crazy, insane contest about who's the most beautiful. And then Zeus decides that Paris is going to decide between Aphrodite and Venus and Athena. But then the goddesses don't ask him to decide. They ask him to decide among the gifts that they'll give him if he chooses them. So, you know, it's off the rails every second. And then his parents believe that he's going to destroy Troy, but they let him back in. So that's nuts. And he has to, it's not clear whether he kidnaps Helen of Troy or she goes with him willingly, but it's crazy that he leaves her alone because his grandmother has died. And so that, like, happens. She could have not died. It's like all these things that could have not happened and Troy wouldn't have burned. So Cassandra thinks that she can intercede somewhere because she thinks this is totally crazy. And time after time, she fails. Despite her best efforts, despite the help of the God of the Winds and the Trojan War lasts 9 years. So Troy comes and the story resumes 9 years later. And even though this does not figure in the Iliad, late in the Trojan War, 9 Amazon women come to the aid of Troy. And I've read this fabulous book about the Amazons and found out that they're not mythical. They were Amazons, and they were Scythians, and they were very powerful women. And Greek women, classical Greek women, didn't leave the house except for religious festival. And they didn't leave the room in the house where they wove. And I imagine they had apartments there. And they left only to be with their husbands. But they spent like 99% of their time stuck in their houses. They had no power. And
that was one thing I loved, was the contrast between you show us the Greek life and how restricted those women were, and then you show us the Amazon, you know, they're these wild nomad warriors. I just love that contrast in the two halves.
Yeah. And also the bow that they used. That was all historical. That was the Scythian bow, and it was smaller, so women could use it more easily. The Greek bow was enormous and all made of wood. And the Scythian bow was part wood, part horn, part glue, and it took years to make. And the bow makers were not warriors because they were so precious they couldn't be lost. You needed to keep those bow makers alive so they could make bows. And it was fascinating to learn about, and I had no idea.
Yeah, that's so cool. And it's such a fun story. When I was, you know, browsing through your books and I saw you'd written a Greek one, I was just stoked because I just think those stories are so exciting. It's such a fun mythos. So you said Cassandra has, you know, like two lines in the Iliad, and you took that and you zoomed in and you showed us, like, well, not just showed us, but help us feel like this is what it might be like to say, to see the future, and then not be able to stop it. And like, we get to feel her pain. Another thing I liked, you brought the east wind to life where he laughs and her hair blows, like these tiny details. So I guess my question is, how did you take something so sparse and then turn it into this vivid picture that we can just immerse ourselves in? What's that process like?
I'm just very curious. I mean, that's what, and I put in too much detail all the time. And generally, I'm cutting 100 pages before it's all over. Because, you know, I want to know who thinks what and what triggers what. And, you know, the when Rin puts on the Greek armor, how itchy is it? And it all fascinates me. It's all, how do you make, what choice do you make? And who are you to make a certain choice? But it doesn't satisfy me unless I understand all about it.
Yeah. Now, and this is interesting, because I've read the Iliad, so it's almost like I've seen the future right alongside Cassandra. And so the whole time, I'm just on pins and needles wondering, oh, man, I've seen the future. Can she alter this future that I personally know and that she has seen?
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
It's just so exciting to deal with that question for the whole book and be wondering what's going to happen.
Yeah. But it was also fun. There's one point where the Amazons make fun of the way the Trojans and the Greek fight. Because in the Iliad, you know, you go up to somebody, you're going to fight. But before you fight, you talk about who their fathers were and who their grandfathers were. And the instance that I described where they decide they like each other too much to fight and they trade armor and then go off and kill other people. And it's so funny. And yet it's also, I mean, one of the things that when I read it, it was so unlike storytelling today. Mm. And it made it ancient. You know, and my storytelling is not ancient. And I don't know that a sixth grader would read the Iliad. Or it would have to be a very special sixth grader because it's so foreign and the storytelling is so different.
Yeah. So I noticed... it was right at the beginning, you talk about the peplos garments, and it just suddenly struck me. I'm like, oh my goodness. So she, like in much of the work you've done in the past, you do what I would call imaginative research. So you have to go in your own head and build a world. But in this book, and I know you have another historical book, but it's very different. You're doing historical research. You've got to go find things rather than make them up. What was it like transitioning to kind of a different sort of project, doing historical rather than more pure fantasy?
Well, my fantasy has gotten more research driven as well, because I'm such a slow writer, and I think I'm slower because, you know, I'm thinking I could make it up, but what does it look like if I look at how other people have imagined dragons, or you know, and you know, like Ella. Was so made up. And nobody goes to the bathroom. Nobody has bad teeth. And, you know, in the Middle Ages, you know, and when kids wrote to me and said, I've learned so much about the Middle Ages from Ella, I was like, oh my God, what have I done? So I mirrors it. And I think it's here. No, it's not. No. But here's something. I use Castle by Macaulay. And I really got to know what a castle is like in later books. So I've gotten more research oriented as time has gone by. My first historical novel, David Knight, the one that is about the boy in the orphanage, was poor me before the internet. So I was doing all that research. It was footwork and it was a lot of book work. And it was really quite different from what it would be today. But I'm now I'm writing one a murder mystery that takes place in 1277, and it's historical. And
in what country?
It's in Winchester, England, and there were a Jewish moneylender was murdered. And the murder, along with her Christian maid, and it was illegal to have a live-in Christian maid, were murdered. And there was a trial, and they accused somebody who had already left town. But none of the historians that I read think that that was the murderer. So it's basically unsolved. And so I've read much more than I need to read to write it. And I'm obsessed with all, with what people did and the choices they made and how I don't understand those choices. Hmm. And so I want to get into their heads and I want to understand the choices. And I don't know. Have you ever watched the series Monk?
I've seen a few episodes, yeah.
Yeah, it's a gift and a curse. Because I just keep reading. So I love the research, but it's really quite different. And then I just pulled this out because I couldn't find the other book. And I've used for years fashion history, European costume. And in, I think it was Paris, I used this book a ton. And some of the things that people wore were just insane. And some of them were gorgeous. And I described, you know, the Elizabethan muff that Queen Elizabeth would wear.
Yeah.
Looks like their heads are on a plate. So I used all that stuff and I jumped from century to century, but it's fun. And then, or tell me if I should stop.
Oh, no, this is great.
Okay. For my book about the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, Ceilings in the Wind, it's about 50 years later, but fashions didn't change that often. I got a book of reproductions of the first book of fashion, and it's medieval. And also because I was writing about about medieval Spain, most of the images come from there. So it was great.
Dang, that's cool. Honestly, I haven't read some of your other stuff, so. I didn't know that you were this deep into the historical side, and that's really cool.
I've learned a ton.
Let me ask you one last question about this, and then we'll move on. I noticed that Sparrows is dedicated to David. Is there a story behind that you'd like to share?
There isn't. It's more, it's time for him to get another dedication. And, you know, he's my husband and I love him and I'm grateful that he's there. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's awesome.
He doesn't fly. He's not the wind.
Which, by the way, I love the romance. I mean, it's kind of subtle and underplayed, but I just love the romance in Sparrows in the Wind. I thought that was...
Thank you.
It's a rewarding storyline. And yeah, especially given that the whole thing starts because Cassandra... pushes away Apollo's advances, like she's saying no, and then you see this kind of more cozy romance that develops, and I love that.
Yeah, not creepy.
Yeah,
Apollo's
yeah.
creepy.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, let's move on to Ella Enchanted. And I'll just tell you, so this was my wife's favorite books growing up. She read it in fourth grade.
Great.
And then a couple months ago, she says to our daughter, like we got to read this. It's so good. And so, honestly, on the first, maybe it's the second or third chapter, Ella encounters tragedy. And my third grade daughter is just like, oh, this is terrible. And she was kind of struggling with it. But then she comes through and she just loves it now.
Oh, good.
Such a fun story. So you received a Newbery honor for that. And I was actually kind of curious about the mechanics of receiving that award. Like, do they send you a letter? Do they call you? Is there an award ceremony? Do they give you an actual medal? Like, tell us more about what that's like.
Yeah, I mean, they call you on the phone, the whole committee. It's a committee of librarians from the American Library Association. And it's something they do out of love because they have to read a zillion books in the year. And they're all happy. They're so happy to be doing it. And I was, you know, I was completely astonished. And they were, oh, we thought we'd have to call you on your job. And I said, no, I'm a full-time writer now. And they cheered. And so it was amazing. And there is an award ceremony. And they're, you know, delighted to see you and meet you and all of that. My ceremony was... was a little marred for me because of what I was wearing. I was wearing this strap, it had a strap across here and it was open in the back and it was like a halter top kind of with a black skirt. It was dressy. But the room where the awards were given was about 50 degrees. It was summer, but it was so cold that I had trouble focusing. So it was like my teeth chattered the whole time. So you know, and I didn't know librarians don't generally show as much flesh as I showed. So they were all prepared, but I wasn't. So that was, it was Karen Hess who won the award that year, and she gave a wonderful speech and gave credit to everybody who helped her make the book. And I got the, and it's a there's the medal that goes on the book, but it's the medal that goes on the paper award, which is put in glass. And I guess laminated against wood or something, and that's what I had. And I have it in the other room, and I'm changed my life, so I'm very happy to have it.
Let's see. Well, so let's talk more about, you just said it changed your life. How did your career change and how did your writing change in that kind of pivotal moment?
I have no idea if this is good or bad, but David Knight had a male protagonist and I was encouraged to have female protagonists after that. And they said, that's my market. And the eternal truth, which is sadly still true, girls read more than boys. So I don't know that that's true later on in life, but in elementary school, junior high, high school, although I think kids read less than they used to anyway. But so that did. I was directed on a path that I followed. And I stuck with fantasy for a long time and fairy tale. And this is not to suggest that this was anything I didn't want to do. I was really happy doing it. And I wrote I wrote the Princess Tales, and each one of them has kind of divides the spotlight between the boy and the girl. And one of them, Cinderella's in The Long Sleep, Cinderella's has more of a role. So he's more, so it is more, a little more boy. But the longer novels have all been girl led by girls.
Oh, that's so cool.
So that did change things.
My daughter wanted me to ask you, how did you come up with the idea for Ella Enchanted?
Well, I read Beauty by Robin McKinley, which I love, which I don't know if third grade would be good, but not because of the content, but I think maybe because of the writing. But fourth or fifth, I loved it. Maybe fifth. I mean, I was an adult, but I was taking a writing class for the first time and knew I'd taken others, but I was taking a new one and I had to write something and I just read Beauty. And I loved fairy tales as a kid and I knew them really well. And I thought, well, maybe I could tell a fairy tale because that's a novelization of Beauty and the Beast. And I thought, well, and what's a biggie? And Cinderella is a biggie. So I thought I'd tell some, Cinderella is the biggest, a biggie. So I thought I'd tell that. And then when I started to think more about it, I didn't understand why she's so kind to that stepfamily when they're only mean to her. And she seemed saccharine to me. And so I got stuck and I couldn't go forward until I thought of the curse. So when I thought of the curse, then she's doing it only because she has to. And she's not sweet at all, particularly. So then I was able to write, you know, it took me a long time to write and I made wrong turns and all that, but that's how I got to it.
Cool. What was it like having your book turned into a movie?
I'm very happy about it. I wasn't happy about it every step of the way, but I'm really happy about it now. And I was happy about it most of the steps of the way. Because, as you know, it's quite different from the book. I think you know. Have you seen the movie?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. And your daughter may weigh in on what the differences are.
Well, for the record, she said she liked the book better.
Good. Initially, the book was not good for the movie because a lot of kids who'd read the book and loved it shunned the movie. But the movie was very good for the book. Yeah. Miramax toured me and in a more comprehensive way than Harper ever had. And the publicity was astonishing and the sales were as well. So both the Newbery and the movie were fabulous for my career. I had something that they called, and you may have read this about it because I'm asked this a fair amount, that I had something called consulting rights, which meant that they had to show me scripts and I got to comment, but they didn't have to do anything that I said.
Sure.
So I still don't think they need an evil uncle and a talking snake. But, you know, there it is. I think it's a fun movie. I think it has a lot of charm, and I love Anne Hathaway in it. But there was a script that they sent me that was misogynist. There was dialogue that was awful about women. And I wrote to the independent producer who had gotten the whole thing rolling, Jane Stark. And I said I was not going to be involved anymore because that was so awful. And she wrote back and said, which turned out to be true so far, this may never happen again, Gail. I think you should lay out everything that bothers you. And I did, and they took it all out.
Oh, that is so awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome, but it's really a mystery to me why they put it in the first place. I mean, what were they thinking? So that part was good. And the elf Slannon, who wants to be a lawyer, that's not in my book. He wants to be a lawyer desperately, but there's so much jargon that goes in with being a lawyer, and they didn't use any of that. So I suggested that they give him lawyer talk, and they did that too. So those were my two contributions to the movie.
Dang, that was so cool.
They also toured. They also let us, David and me, spend 3 days on the set, and that was fun. They didn't let us interfere, but they let us be there and see how it worked. And
yeah,
we could have stayed the whole time, but it was 3 days that we were given.
So, yeah, you have pictures of that visit on your website. And yeah, our listeners, I'll put that in the show notes so you can
great
go see it. But yeah, it's really cool. Okay, so I would love to talk about your Neverland trilogy. And we're getting a little short on time. Could you just introduce our listeners, tell them what that is, and why did you want to write about Neverland?
It's the fairies of Peter Pan's Neverland. And I love Peter Pan and Anne of Green Gables, I think, were my absolute favorite book when I was a kid. And I was myself a pretty obedient kid. But James M. Barry offers a very different idea about childhood, about it being transgressive and kids are inconsiderate and selfish. I wasn't much those things, and I loved the freedom. And so I read Peter Pan over and over and over again.
Sure.
And then it didn't occur to me to do anything with it, but Disney came to me and said that they were starting a series about the fairies of Neverland. They wanted me to develop the world. And since I love Peter Pan so much, I was excited about it. And I went back to Peter Pan and I read it again. I looked very, very closely at Barry's writing. And I appreciated it in a way that I didn't as a kid. Which is that he is in a really supple writer, and he can take a sentence from New York to Kansas in this kind of a route and end up exactly where he wants to be. And I couldn't do it. I could not. I wanted to see if I could use some of his writing strategies, because they're amazing. And I couldn't. It was, I didn't have this attitude. Because he had a lot of attitude. But I noticed that he wrote, of course. He threw in the phrase, of course, all over the place. So I did that. And then they told me not to put Hook or Peter Pan into it.
Well, so Peter Pan comes in book three.
He comes in book one a little bit, but I did it anyway. I had the idea that if they didn't talk, it would be okay. And they asked for more Hook. So I put more Hook in. It was funny. Those books were really, especially the first two, I got a little lost on the third. But the first two were a ton of fun to write. It was fun to be invited into the world of Peter Pan and to be able to do my own thing with it.
I just want to say, I'm also a huge fan of Peter Pan, and that's why I want to talk about this with you.
Yeah.
And I noticed your attention to the detail. I mean, you have a moment where you say Peter was the sort of kid who would switch sides in the battle to make sure that the battle kept going, and stuff like that. And I could see that, yeah, you knew Barry's writing really well. I feel like kind of, you know, reviving it. And I guess you can say the attitude is maybe a little different. But yeah, I just think you made a wonderful contribution to that world.
And in the last book, I poke a lot of fun at him because he's totally self-involved.
Yeah.
And he's brave and he'll come in at the last minute, but he won't come in earlier than that.
Yeah.
So that was also fun to do. And I did not put in the Redskins because that would have, that really becomes very questionable today.
Yeah.
And so I gave a dragon and those other creatures that don't ever come into it very much.
So I am not familiar with Disney's fairy world or what they've done. So did they, had they already started producing something? And yeah. Then they said, oh, so they, well, like, did you invent these characters or is this them or like, what did they give
you? No, they gave me a few illustrations from, Bambi, I think. And there was a dove that they gave me a picture of that, I love the illustration and that's where Mother Dove came from.
Yeah.
But the deal with Disney, even though I don't own the copyright, the deal was that I had editorial control. And, but I mean, there were things that they wanted, like, they wanted, they had opinions about names. So, because they were trying to coordinate with the video department and there were obstacles and all that, but they wanted names to be similar. So, but some of the names that they wanted, I hated. So I, like Vidia, they wanted Invidia, which seemed too on the nose to me for a bad character. So I made it Vidia, which is, you know, not quite as
I like it.
There. Yeah. And then I thought that they were going to follow it with books that were like mine, and they didn't. They used a lot of the world as a scaffolding, but they the other books are for a much younger age group. So it's not, they sit uneasily together, to my mind. They, instead of Fairy Haven, it's Pixie Hollow. Instead of fairies, they're pixies. And I'm not crazy about that at all. But
yeah, that's kind of a weird change.
Yeah, and it's a big change. So, but I had no control over that. It's okay. Because mine is Fairy Haven and fairies. And so, I'm just thinking about the other books. They're just different.
Okay. Yeah. Well, cool. Yeah. I have very much enjoyed your trilogy. I actually haven't quite finished the third one. But, let's talk about your writing. I read a quote of yours that said, "Some books, but not mine, are character driven. Mine are plot and idea driven." Tell me, why do you write that way?
Well, I told you about the curiosity. That's why. It's the curiosity into why people make decisions, which drives plot. Why, I mean, the characters are super important. And when you read that quote, I thought, well, I don't start with character. I thought, start with plot. And I look for characters who are going to go in the direction of the plot. And, you know, like when I wrote the expulsion book, it's the Middle Ages. And my female main character had to have agency. So I set everything up so she would at a time when women had none. And I didn't make her a child who wanted agency. I made it her a child who was very happy not to have it. But circumstances force her into it. And she grows into that agency. But it was that plot framework that I did. So, I mean, I make her grandfather, who is the patriarch and is very wealthy and very engaged in helping other Jews. And that's the most important thing in the world to him. And he becomes very, very attached to her. And keeps her and finds things. She's a brilliant mathematician. and he wants her brain with him all the time. So he takes her with him on his trips across Spain. Sometimes it's just her and him and servant. And then I gave him apoplexy so that he has mini strokes. When she has to, even though she's quite young, she has to take charge. And that's how I gave her agency through this connector.
Yeah,
and that's the way that I think about it.
Yeah, I love that. Are you involved in marketing? Do you have marketing efforts? And if so, what do you do? What do you like to do as far as marketing goes? And what do you not like doing as far as marketing goes?
Well, I regard talking to you as a little bit on the publicity side. And that's because I listened to your interview with William Dietz. And he said that. And I thought, yeah, right. And I have somebody who does, just a few hours a week, she does Instagram and Facebook for me. And she comes up with where we should direct the posts. Because if she didn't do it, I wouldn't. Because that's not what I'm interested in doing. Obviously, I like to talk, and I like to talk to people, and I like to go to schools, and I like to go to libraries. And it hasn't been happening as much as it used to. But I was in Indiana and Arizona 1 week apart, and then nothing after or before. But anyway, I was at libraries in both places. And that's because, my website says, invite me.
Yeah.
And so I like to be invited. When I do events, we put it on the website and put it on Instagram and Facebook. And I'm glad I'm not publishing independently, because that would be more time than I would want to spend on it.
Mm.
I'm a very slow writer, so it would be impossible.
Why do you think you're a slow writer?
Well, I told you why I'm a, part of why I'm a slow writer is that the research and me getting very interested in sidelines that may not mean anything. And I don't outline. I haven't figured that out. I outline a little, and I have to know at the end that I'm writing toward it. But I get lost. I wander around. On this mystery, I'm in a critique group that's wonderful, and they're getting a little worried because it's taking me so long to get to. This is a story, and I hope I'm going to be able to figure it out when I revise. But there's a lot of setup. The mystery doesn't become a mystery until the second person is murdered. Because before that, they think it's solved. And when the second person is murdered, these three kids who are the protagonists know that the person who was believed to be the murderer, who had skipped town, did not commit the murder. And they know who the third victim is going to be. And they have to protect her. But I'm on page 100, and the second murder hasn't happened yet. And so I'm a little alarmed about this. I'm also not positive about who the murderer is. I'm very sure about what's going to happen in terms of catching the murderer. And I have the final scene in my head, and I love it. But getting there is being a very, very tough climb. So that's why I'm so slow.
I just have to say, you're telling it to me right now makes me excited. It seems like an exciting story.
Yeah, it is an exciting story.
Yeah. So in your you wrote a book about writing.
Two.
And you have
actually.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So your first one, the writer, Writing Magic, has a quote, the writer's oath. And it says, I promise solemnly to write as often and as much as I can, to respect my writing self and to nurture the writing of others. How'd you come up with this oath?
Well, it's for kids. And I thought an oath kind of solemnizes the thing and makes a commitment. So that's how, you know, and then I thought about what, and I thought about how now, the last time I looked at that, I thought, oh, writing enough. Geez.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's how I came up with it.
Okay. Yeah. So I love that you say to nurture the writing of others. And I think there's two types of criticism, and one is negative and drags people down, and one is positive and helps you might write a good next draft. And I mean, I guess you mentioned your writing group. Are they the ones who give you that positive criticism and help you write a solid next draft?
Well, I'm new to this group. Well, I was operating without a group for a long time.
Who beta read your books before this group then?
Well, early I was in critique groups. And then I was in a critique group that got much smaller, and it was just one person, my great friend, Joan Abelot. And then Joan got a brain tumor and got a brain injury, and she's alive, but she can't be my critique buddy anymore. And I did not join another critique group after that until now. And that's quite a while. So my beta reader has been my editor, and she's fabulous. But I like being in a critique group. I like seeing other people's work. I like helping them. I like the whole deal. So I'm glad to be in a critique group.
Yeah. Did you ever encounter negative critique? And if and when you do, how do you deal with it?
Well, I don't know if you read the Mr. Pashkin story about me. Mr. Pashkin was my creative writing teacher in high school. And I didn't start writing till I was 39 because of Mr. Pashkin. Because he wrote on top of one of my stories, you know your problem, you're pedestrian. And if you know what pedestrian means other than somebody who walks, you know he was saying I'm boring. And he didn't just say my story was boring. He said I was. And I believed him, which, you know, I didn't never questioned it. And I never thought that a boring person could write an interesting story. And it wasn't until I was in the commerce department and they liked my writing that that changed that. So I also I have a bad habit of reading Goodread reviews. And they're often not really thought out. They're often just damaging. And I think I read them because I want to know if people are thinking about me. I mean, I think that's it. And I just kind of, I feel bad for 2 minutes and then I go on to the next thing.
Oh, really?
But if somebody, you know, I think I'm armored enough or skilled enough or something to suss out when somebody is, sugarcoating something that's mean, where you might not know to get it right away, but you find yourself feeling bad.
Yeah.
I think I that has not happened to me in forever. The worst person is me. You know, I have to really watch myself.
Huh.
And there's, I don't know, do you write? Are you into writing?
Yep, absolutely.
Because there's a, have you read Writing on Both Sides of the Brain?
No.
That's a fabulous book about that negative voice and where it comes from and how to recognize it and how to arm oneself against it. And I went to that a great deal when I was getting started.
Well, I will look that up because, yeah, I think criticism is fundamental. And I just feel like you need feedback to be a good writer. But yeah, just with the internet and these non-face-to-face conversations can be brutal. And I think it's cool that you describe yourself as having enough armor. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so one of your fans, Amanda, wrote to me, "It's one thing to get awards and have bestsellers, but books become so personal to the people who read them and who write them. So what's an unexpected way that the writing of your books has affected your own life, and what's an unexpected way that your books have affected the life of a reader?"
Well, affected my own life. There are so many ways. I mean, you know, in terms of writing, I'm having a lot of trouble with this book, but I've had a lot of trouble with other books. So I have enough experience to be fairly confident I'm going to finish it. I mean, unless old age gets in the way and, you know, like that. But other than that, I think I'm going to finish it. And that's big. You know, that, you know, you fail enough, you start succeeding, and you start knowing that you're going to get there. But also what really surprised me is how much travel it brought into my life. Disney toured me to Japan, Australia, all over Europe.
Really?
Yeah. And I visited army bases in Germany. And while I was there, I toured a little bit for Dave at Night, which was coming out in German. I visited a school in Taiwan and one in Thailand, and then I know geography better, and New Yorkers famously don't, but I know geography better because I've been to a lot of places. I've been to more states in the United States than I expected. I got to go to Israel, which surprised me. Lots of, you know, that was the biggest. Wow, look at
this. How did Israel surprise you?
It wasn't on my list. I'm Jewish, but it wasn't on my list. I'm not religious. So this organization called PJ Library, which is like a book club for Jewish books, and David Knight is a Jewish book, and even though they didn't take Ceiling, it's a Jewish book, and they encourage writing of books that are connected to Judaism. And as part of that, they brought a bunch, and now I think they've done it twice, and they're planning the third one, to Israel, sort of as tourists, but with a historical and Jewish culture emphasis. It was an all-expense-paid trip to Israel.
Wow.
That and I got to learn a great deal about Israel, not about the Arab-Israeli conflict because they stayed away from that, but and I have this cube of salt from the Dead Sea because it crystallizes, you know. So that's been such a great surprise.
Do you have fans write in stories about, you know, your book gave me the courage to do this? Or,
well, there is what there are, you know, kids do write me like that. And what Ella or Two Princesses of Vermar also has meant to them. The one, however, and I've told this more than once, that, you know, just blew me away was this young woman who wrote to me about reading Ella at the same time that she got a diagnosis of Tourette's. And she took her Tourette's to be like Ella's curse because it made her do things she didn't want to do. And she fought it like Ella does. And she said people can't tell she has Tourette's.
Mm. Wow.
And that was like, and I think that she would have done it anyway, and something else would have been enabled her. But I'm very grateful that Ella was the thing that did it.
That's so cool. I love that story. Awesome. Let me ask you, these are just going to be fast questions as we wrap up. What software do you use to write?
Oh, I use Word. I used Word Perfect for years. I loved Word Perfect, but finally it just became...
And it kind of went out. Yeah,
it went out, and I used it after it went out, but it became too cumbersome.
What's your favorite game?
Game? Oh, God. I'm a little bit addicted to FreeCell Solitaire my phone. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a fun game. What does work-life balance look like in your life?
You know, people who work for themselves always have demons about it. About never doing enough. And these days, I do get in less, you know, like this. The shoulder injury. I was in physical therapy that took up way too much time. And now I'm finished. And there are more hours in the day. But I still have, it will come back. If you don't have it operated on, it's going to come back. So I do still have to do a fair amount of my own rehab. And since I'm a writer, I'm very disciplined and I do it. And then I also had cataract surgery. And that was also, you know, a time that stole. This year has been, I've been robbed of a lot of time this year. But also, you know, I write poetry and I'm in a poetry critique group. We meet every other week and I have to deliver a poem every week, and I sacrificed some writing of my book for poetry because I love doing it and I love the people in the group. And and then the working out and the cardio. And so there are things that get in the way, and then sometimes I'm my own worst enemy, but not so much because I am really work focused. The Protestant ethic is strong in me.
That's awesome. I think your poetry, that sounds really meaningful. That sounds like a good group. Yeah. What book are you going to read tonight?
What book am I going to read tonight? I'm in the middle of Bud. I'm near the end of Bud by Terry Pratchett. I love Terry Pratchett. So maybe I'll read a little of Bud, or maybe I'll wind up playing FreeCell. So I don't know how the answer to that one.
Okay. Favorite dead author and favorite living author?
Oh, favorite dead author is Jane Austen. I love the work of my friend Virginia Ewer Wolfe, and my favorite book of hers is The Mozart Season. So she won the National Book Award for Make Lemonade, which is a verse novel, and it's beautiful. But my absolute favorite is The Mozart Season.
So I'm not familiar with either of those, but I will look them up.
Yeah.
Sounds interesting. Do you have a favorite book to recommend to a third grade girl?
Somebody was talking about Karen Cushman. Yes, last night at the critique group. And I think she's, you know, she won the Newbery Honor for The Midwife's Apprentice. And I think she would be great for third grade. Also, and I think The Moor Child by Eloise, The Moor Child. Just look it up. It won the Newbery Honor, and it's fantasy, and it's absolutely fabulous.
Oh, Cool.
Look at it first to see if it's too, both of them, to see if they're too hard. But yeah. They probably won't be.
Okay. And then this is the final question.
Let me read one more. Peter Pan, if she hasn't read it.
Actually, she hasn't, and it's one I would love to read.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Good. I'm glad you said that. What is the one book that has had the greatest impact on your life?
Oh, Pride and Prejudice, for sure.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, the sense of humor is and has helped shape me.
Yeah.
Because I read it as a kid. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. What a good choice. Okay, if someone listening wants to keep connected to you and know what's going on, like how your projects are developing, where should they go?
Well, my website is GailCarsonLevine.com. It's really easy. And, you know, if you Google me, you'll find it. But it's GailCarsonLevine.com. And I have a guest book. People can write on the guest book. If people would like, if kids are, you know, writers, I teach a writing workshop that's free every summer in July. And I live in Brewster. They need to get in touch with the Brewster Public Library. And I was going to go back to in person, but the kids seem to like it better remote. So I did it hybrid this year, but most of the kids were remote. So I'm going to do it remote next year. So people zoom in from anywhere.
Oh, yeah, across the nation.
The world. I head to Puerto Rico.
Yeah, that's excellent. Gail, I would like to give you the final words. I don't know if you have a piece of advice for our listeners. So, in fact, I didn't even say this, but our listeners are people who write novels or who want to learn how to write novels. So I don't know if you have advice. I don't know if you have an ask, something you want to ask of our listeners, or maybe there's a question that I should have asked that I didn't and you want to answer that. But yeah, I'll give you the final words. What would you like to say as we close?
Well, sure, if it's an ask, I would ask them to read Becoming a Writer by Dorothea Brand at Brande. And it's a book that I found very helpful. But it's also a challenging book. It's very old-fashioned. I think it was written in the 20s. She assumes her entire readership is male. It talks about how hard it is to be a writer. It goes into that quite a bit. And then it says, you know, you should find out if this is something you can do. And so it gives people something, you know, a challenge to write at a certain time every day for a short period, but to write, you know, and it doesn't matter what you write. And it doesn't need to be fiction. It can be journaling. It can be anything. And then she changes it up a little. And if you can't do it, if you find that you fail time after time after time at putting that small amount of time into it, then writing is not something that you're going to get anywhere with. And I don't think it's a bad thing to have that. I mean, some people will say, expletive deleted you and go ahead and be able to do it. But some will also get a heads up that this isn't for them. So I think that it's not bad to do that.
That is excellent advice. I will put a link to that book in the show notes.
Great.
Gail, thank you so much. This has been a great pleasure for me. I have loved reading your books, and so has my family.
Great.
Anyway, thank you so much. And to our listeners, it's time to start writing.
Tyranny rules the galaxy. Tiberos has crushed every hint of rebellion. Like the grip of his cybernetic hand, he maintains a relentless hold on the populace. The power he hates most is the psionic magic of the song. A force so strong it flows out as light from the eyes. People with such powers are called radiances. and Tiberosa's witch hunters kidnap any that surface. As the radiances slowly vanish, so does the galaxy's hope. Till Kal-El White Sun, one of the last radiances, gives a risky speech denouncing Tiberos and the extermination of her kind. The message spreads across the galaxy like the light of a supernova. She becomes revered as the uncrowned queen, the one with the power to finally unite the people. And then, doom falls, in the form of the crushing hand of Tiberos. He captures Kal-El, sentencing her to the darkest dungeons and imminent death. All hope is lost. Until a lone pilot appears. A pilot who wants nothing to do with Kal-El or her rebellion. Yet who may in fact be the galaxy's last hope. A pilot whose ship, the Sanctum, was created by an ancient alien race. A pilot who stole that ship from Tiberos himself. A renegade pilot named Starchild.
Get the Starchild paperback, ebook, or audiobook at starchild.jwashburn.com.